Well, Bill, what prompted your interest in the subject of how pornography affects the brain?
As a researcher in graduate school, I was very much interested in the mechanisms of arousal, and that one of the easiest ways that you can get an organism aroused is to put it in a sexual context. So as I was studying as a graduate student, I became very interested in what was going on. Found was that there was an awful lot of research that was out there that was examining the psychological factors of things like pornography and its effect on the way that people think about sexuality, the way that they behave, but very little that could be translated. A plethora of male students, especially, who would come up to me after class and say, "I'm really, really struggling with this." And I never realized how many guys out there who are struggling with pornography. And so what I wanted to do is I just wanted to kind of see this as part of my ministry, that I could take the skills that I did have and my expertise in this area and apply it in a way that would help men better understand what happens when they watch pornography, why it has such a pull on them, and what are the consequences to acting out to it.
Your book, Wired for Intimacy, is written specifically to men. When I noticed this, it was really striking to me. I know, well, for instance, several weeks ago, I had the privilege, we had the privilege of sitting down over dinner, and we had a really kind of a neat group sitting there with us. We had Michael Leahy with us, who's the author of Porn Nation. We had Crystal Renault at the table with us, who's the founder of a ministry for women who struggle with pornography. And I couldn't help but notice as we were kind of sitting there at the table and talking and just sharing that we had a woman there who has suffered from pornography addiction. And yet your book is subtitled How Pornography Hijacks the Male Brain. Is there any particular reason why you decided to focus in on, or why you decided to focus your attention on the male brain and not just...
to do was to kind of come to the conversation and say, look, we talk an awful lot about male and female bodies, and an awful lot of fuss is made over the fact that they're different and that we're created different, and certainly you you know, one area's a little bit bigger here and one area's a little bit smaller there, or maybe some of the connections are thinner over in this, you know, for men or for women. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to kind of bring people's attention to the fact that the brain doesn't develop like the remarkably different. And what I wanted to do in focusing on the male brain is to just acknowledge the reality that, look, male brains are different. In some ways, they're very similar, but in some ways they are critically different. and it's these critical differences that are important for why pornography has such a draw to them, that they're built and they're wired in such a way that they don't have to learn to be attracted to pornography. They just sort of are wired to be attracted to pornography. Women who are pulled into pornography, it's sort of a long pull that brings them into that. It's almost like a learned addiction or a learned compulsion to pornography, whereas men, it's kind of unlearned. It's almost a reflexive kind of response. So what you're seeing is that as pornography is becoming more acceptable in the mainstream, and as women are hearing that, you know, this is what they're supposed to be, they're sort of learning that this is the way that they're supposed to be and being trained into it, whereas men really are sort of reflexively being pulled into it.
In your book, you mention at least six sets of hormones and neurotransmitters that are at play in the wiring of our brains, specifically as it pertains to this subject. I'd like to talk about each of them sort of one by one, just so we can give our listeners a feel for this.
Sure.
The first one you mentioned is testosterone.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, I'm assuming everybody knows this, but I want to make sure just in case. Testosterone is the hormone that is produced by the testes in the male. So testosterone is the hormone that, generally speaking, is involved in a lot of things. I mean, it's involved in muscle development, it's involved in bone development, it's involved in, you know, any number of things. But it certainly is tied to the male sexual drive. And so when you castrate, whether it be, you know, an animal or a human, that you're going to see there's a remarkable reduction in libido. So the person just won't be as interested in sex as they normally would be. So testosterone seems to be the hormone that is driving the interest in sex. Now, testosterone is a hormone, which means that it can be produced in waves and in surges. And because it's a hormone, it has its effects over an extended period of time. So while you might look at a pornographic image, that will trigger sort of a reflexive response to release this kind of a wave of testosterone. And as you continue to keep looking, or you continue to keep watching, or you continue to fantasize as well, to mentally kind of have an image going through your head, what will happen is that will keep this slow release of testosterone building and building and building. And oftentimes that's what's going to be associated with this feeling of just intense pressure that's been building up over the day, this desire for sex that's been building up and up. So in the case of viewing pornography, the testes are going to, you know, produce their testosterone. It's going to be released in the system, and it's going to affect the system for an extended period of time. Now, the testes don't know whether this is your wife or that
right.
This is a digital image. They don't really care. That's their job. So in the case of, let's say, a relationship between a husband and a wife, you know, presumably a husband is going to be going, you know, throughout his day looking at, you know, any number of images or women in the world. That's going to build up this testosterone level. And if he's not careful, what's going to happen is you're going to get that feeling of, I have to get rid of this. And so you're going to sexually act out. Sometimes men will direct that towards their spouse. Sometimes they'll use, you know, they'll masturbate in response to pornography, or they'll masturbate even without pornography. But testosterone is this gonadal hormone that's really driving the interest in sex.
Okay. And the next one you mentioned is dopamine. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, dopamine is a neurotransmitter that's produced in many places in the brain, but in the deep part of the brain, in a region called the mesencephalon, down in the tegmentum, there are a couple of spots that produce an awful lot of dopamine. And dopamine is released by this area into higher brain centers. And one particular pathway that's an important pathway that I talk about in the book is what's called the mesolimbic pathway. Now, the meso part of that pathway is the deep part of the brain, the midbrain, where the dopamine is being produced. And the limbic part of the brain are these higher order parts of the brain, like the cortex and what's referred to sometimes as the limbic system, which is involved in emotion and learning.
Okay.
Now, dopamine is produced down in this deep part of the brain, and it's released into these higher centers of the brain, and they're tied to specifically things that are drive-related. You know, you need to eat. You need to drink, right? And so when you find food when you're hungry and you find water when you're thirsty, that meets a need and it satisfies the need. And it feels good when that need is satisfied, but you want to remember. substances like, you know, cocaine and amphetamine can cause a surge in dopamine levels in these higher brain areas. And sometimes people say, well, that's, you know, that's a pleasure center. And really, it's not a pleasure center. Dopamine is not about pleasure. Dopamine is almost more about focus and significance. It's, I have to have this thing. So dopamine is the neurotransmitter that's much more tied to things like cravings. Like, I've got to get this drug, or I've got to, you know, get my porn, or I've got to get X, Y, or Z, whatever it is, you know, to gamble or to do whatever it is. It's not sexually specific like testosterone seems to be, but it's much more just a craving or a compulsive kind of neurotransmitter that's saying, this is the important thing, this is what I need, and here's where I get it.
So dopamine is what helps the brain attach significance to the experience.
Right. And dopamine is released in small packets. Because it's a neurotransmitter, it's released in small quantities across the very narrow time, as opposed to testosterone, which is released in these kind of waves of hormones that get into the blood. Dopamine is released by one neuron onto an adjacent neuron across what they call a synapse. So dopamine, you have these small little tiny packets of dopamine that are being released, and their effects can be very short-lived, as opposed to testosterone, which is a much longer live type of hormone. The neurotransmitter dopamine is really there to help us remember and to isolate and to focus on the things that we think are important.
So a repeated use of pornography in someone's life with the associated pleasure of that, and dopamine is being released in that process, and it's essentially training the brain to say, this is the most important thing you need.
Exactly. Well, and I would say dopamine in some ways is the way that you've remembered what has worked in the past, and therefore that's what you're seeking in the future.
Gotcha.
So that when something happens, you say, oh, how did, you know, what did I do the last time that I felt sexually aroused? Well, I engaged in this kind of behavior, and that gave me, you know, a huge payoff for it. And say, oh, okay, that's what I got to do again. How do I get access to that information? And so the dopamine will be the thing that underlies the craving for it, rather than the actual pleasure that you get itself.
Gotcha. Okay. And the next one you mentioned is norepinephrine.
Yeah, norepinephrine. Norepinephrine is sometimes called noradrenaline. And so norepinephrine is the brain's version of adrenaline. Right? You've probably heard of, you know, adrenaline is a hormone that's released by the adrenal glands on the kidneys that sort of ramps people up, right? When people hear a loud gunshot, or they're being, you know, chased by a, you know, by a lion. I haven't been chased by a lion recently, but you know, if I was, well, my adrenal glands would produce adrenaline, and that would get my body ready to act and to run away or to defend myself. Well, norepinephrine looks an awful lot like adrenaline, but it's found in the brain. It's not circulating as a hormone in the body. And norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter that seems to be very involved in arousing us. And not a sexually specific type of arousal, but just general arousal. Norepinephrine is the neurotransmitter that helps you wake up and go to sleep and wake up and go to sleep and to pay attention in class and to kind of stay awake at work. And so norepinephrine is a neurotransmitter that we find that in response to sort of sexual stimuli, not only do you have testosterone driving this thing, which is sort of a flood occurring throughout the body with testosterone, you have dopamine sort of highlighting this is the significant thing that you need to be focusing on in the brain. Norepinephrine is also heightening the other parts of the brain to say, we need to focus. We need to kind of prepare the body that something is about to happen here, so it's going to ramp itself up to be ready for something to happen. And that's what norepinephrine does.
Okay. And the next one you mentioned is serotonin. What is
right.
that?
Serotonin is another neurotransmitter, just like dopamine and norepinephrine. It's released in small quantities in the brain, and it's very short-lived for the most part. But serotonin is tied to mood. Maybe for Prozac, right? You know, SSRI.
Right, yeah.
Drugs that are given as antidepressants. When serotonin levels are low, well, people can struggle with depression. And so this notion that when serotonin is being released, that you're not getting maybe even a specific sex mood that is being elevated, but just general mood, you know, general emotion is being elevated. So while dopamine is important for saying this is what you have to do to get some kind of emotional payoff, norepinephrine is saying, all right, we're going to help you get ready to get the payoff. Serotonin is the excitement that's kind of building alongside of it. Norepinephrine is priming the brain to be excited, and serotonin is being involved in helping us say, yeah, this is fun, this is good, I kind of like this. So that's what serotonin is doing.
And the next one you mentioned is endogenous opiates. Well, right. What are those?
Well, most people have heard of opiates. You know, they've heard of opium, which is a drug. Well, we know that the body produces a natural form of an opium. And so that's why they're called endogenous, which means the body's making it, endogenous opiates. And there's a couple different opiates that the body does produce. Some of them are for getting rid of pain, like morphine is an opiate that helps people, you know, get rid of pain. But there are other types of opiates that the body produces called endorphins. And many people may have heard of, you know, endorphins as, you know, the things that are released when you get a runner's high or something like that. You know, you run and you run and you run, and then you break through the runner's wall and you get this incredible kind of feeling, this wave of kind of euphoria. Well, these endorphins that are produced in the male are easily released whenever a man ejaculates. So that kind of high that you feel, that sort of almost transcendent kind of experience that you feel, where all the pain kind of leaves your body and there's this wave of pleasure that courses over your body, is the result of these endogenous endorphins that are being released. And so if you think about this within the context of kind of, you know, what a guy might be going through, as he's going through his day and he's thinking about sex, his testosterone levels are beginning to increase. And as he thinks more and more about it, well, he's going to start to now see, I need to deal with this. I need to kind of get rid of this tension, because the tension is now building in the form of norepinephrine levels going up. He's also maybe beginning to feel a little bit excited about the prospect that he's going to get a payoff for this. So what will happen is serotonin levels will increase, and the dopamine levels are now saying, you have to go back to the porn. You have to go back to something that is a reliable way that you know that gives you a great payoff. And so when a guy looks at porn and all these neurotransmitters and all of these hormones are kind of coming together in this, you know, crescendo of the symphony of neurochemistry, what happens is he acts out to it, but let's say just by masturbating, and you get this huge release of endorphins, and it's a massive payoff. And so it feels wonderful for that, you know, that time that is, those endorphins are in your brain. And then these endorphins sort of gradually cascade away and everything slows down and you go back to kind of a feeling of, you know, kind of normalcy, for lack of a better word.
Okay. The last couple you mentioned are oxytocin and vasopressin. Why don't you just describe what those are
sure.
to round this out?
Oxytocin and vasopressin are hormones that are produced in the brain that are also oftentimes released in response to orgasm, so in response to ejaculation. And so we think about hormones like testosterone as driving this system, and we think about the neurotransmitters as helping us kind of fine-tune what we're supposed to be and to prepare for it. And these endorphins are released, and they produce these kind of short-acting effects of euphoria. But in response to orgasm, you also find that there are hormones that are released. These oxytocins, vasopressin hormones are released, and they tend to help lay down the memories for the cells. They help the brain remember, so that when dopamine goes back and says, what was that we were focusing on? Oh, yeah, it's, you know, sitting down in front of this digital image or this particular website or this particular model or whatever it is. Oxytocin and vasopressin are changing the long-term response of these cells. So they're kind of forming the memories inside the cells themselves, so that they are now binding whatever it was that elicited this massive euphoria. We were going to be bound to it. We're going to kind of come back to it regularly. And if it's a reliable thing, we're going to be now in what I would say kind of a relationship with it as well. So oxytocin and vasopressin are the hormonal ways of forming and the bond between the organism, which in this case is the guy, and whatever it was that he behaviorally bound himself to.
And so this soup of hormones and neurotransmitters that are all sort of acting in this biological symphony that's going on, this not only works in a way where it leads people towards addiction to pornography, these also are meant to work in positive ways, in bonding us to a significant other, bonding us to a wife, bonding us to a spouse.
Right, and that's the beautiful thing about this. I mean, people look at these systems and they say, oh, wow, there's lots of ways that things can go bad here. I really look at it and I say, wow, this is the way we're built. And there's a beautiful design behind this, that if this thing is directed appropriately towards a spouse, then you're going to be bound to your spouse. And that's going to image God and his exclusive love, as Christ loves his church. That's what you want. And it's not something that you're going to forget either. It's not something that you have to try a little bit harder to do. It's just something that is going to happen as a result of that sexual response and the sexual acting out. And so, you know, I don't think you can underestimate the importance of, you know, a husband and a wife being sexually intimate with each other. And in the male, this is how this intimacy is almost sort of seared into him, so that he would have, you know, a love for the woman that he's with and not for others. That he might look, you know, at other beautiful women throughout the day and maybe even get a little bit of a testosterone surge over that, but that surge is channeled into his wife. You know, that is, you know, that those elevated dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin levels are sort of channeled into his
right.
wife, and the net effect will be that these opiates will be released and his euphoria will be with his wife. You know, that the oxytocin and vasopressin will kind of bind him to his wife and less to others.
Now, I'm putting myself in the shoes of the man who's listening right now who's not married, and
right.
he may be hearing this and says, okay, so for guys like me who don't have that godly sexual outlet through marriage,
right. mm-hmm.
what hope is there for me to rewire my brain in this? What hope is there for this?
Well, I think that's where each guy has to kind of look at his own experience, you know, and look at his own life. Because if a guy has been in a long relationship with pornography, some of these things have already been laid down. So I think, my first thing would be, you know, whatever you're doing now, the best first step is to stop just kind of keeping this circuit running and keeping, you know, relearning this pathway and deepening this pathway and realizing that, you know, there are other ways that you can direct these surges of testosterone, these surges of dopamine, these surges of norepinephrine and serotonin, and direct them in ways that are much more positive. And it's going to be a difficult task right up at the front, but you will pick up what I like to call, you know, neurohormonal momentum. You know, that after a while of learning how to deal with your testosterone surges, of for what works for you as a person, but thinking about how your external environment, you know, how the world that you live in and the things that you expose yourself to cause these things to happen, you know, trying to find ways to identify what are the cues, you know, what are the triggers that cause these things to happen, not just 5 minutes before I make the decision, you know, do I log on and look at the porn or do I go to the strip club or whatever it is, but to be building your world in such a way to reduce these things, because when they're reduced, it's much more manageable. It's much less of an issue.
Well, that's great. Oh,
I would want to add one more thing, too. I think that our culture tells us that a guy has to have a regular orgasm, right? And so as a result,
yeah.
he sort of has to take matters, you know, in his own hands, so to speak, no pun intended. And I really think we miss the opportunity of, and I mentioned this in the book a little bit, there's something about when a man has a nocturnal emission, wet dream, there's a protective value that the brain has when that happens during sleep, so that it doesn't really have the same kind of binding effect that it has when he's awake. So that, you know, when you have a wet dream, you're not going to be bound to something, because in some ways the brain's kind of, you know, dampened down quite a bit because it's asleep. So it won't be able to focus in on and say, what was that? You know, what was that we were binding ourselves to? And so the net effect is that you won't be bound to whatever it was that triggered the wet dream. And the wet dream is kind of God's release mechanism for men who have this buildup of this sexual energy, for it to be, for that to occur during sleep, so that you don't get this huge euphoria that then binds you to something. You don't learn a behavioral pattern, which then sort of directs you to be much more likely to do it the next time. So, you know, I really, you know, talk with a lot of the single guys that I work with and say, that's a victory when you have a wet dream. When you have a nocturnal emission, that is a victory that you should celebrate. As weird as that sounds,
yeah.
That's a sign that you are allowing God's natural mechanism for you to deal with this increased sexual, with your sexual urges by following the mandates of Scripture, which is to not masturbate, which is to not sexually act out with someone who is not your wife.
In your book, you also talk a great deal about the nature of masculinity. What are some of the cultural beliefs about masculinity, and more importantly, how does buying into those beliefs about masculinity contribute to the way pornography works on a man's mind?
Oh, sure. I think, you know, to think of masculinity is a manifestation of humanity. So if we can think first of ourselves as human beings and then as male human beings, what we find is that, you know, some guys will say, you know, I don't feel like a man. And you know, that because I, you know, have a lot of these feminine traits. And I say, well, you're a human being, number one. And the things that you're concerned about are human traits. So don't worry too much about that. So if we think about, you know, what our culture tells us, is our culture tells us that men are supposed to be competitive. Men are supposed to be aggressive. Men are supposed to be, you know, dominating. Men are supposed to be stoic emotionally. Men are supposed to use actions and not words. You know, these are the cultural beliefs that we learn. But the reality is that those are not necessarily exclusively masculine in the same way that a penis is exclusively male. Now, intimacy is really a human need. It's a need to know and to be known. But our culture tells men intimacy is about manipulation of your genitals, and that's really what it is. Everything else really doesn't count as intimacy. Talking with your wife, you know, having a ministry with other men, you know, to be intimate with other men, that just elicits kind of a homophobia immediately when you start talking about that. But the idea that intimacy is more of a human need and is not synonymous with the genitals is something that men don't hear in our culture. So they think of that as something that's different. It's not really intimacy. Intimacy is about, you know, me putting my penis inside something or someone manipulating my penis. Or it's about the size of my penis, right?
Right.
I was up late last night and I was kind of working on some things, and you know, you see all these late night ads for Extends and all these male enhancements. I said, well, male enhancement.
Right.
Why does that have to be having a bigger penis? Why can't that be being a better husband? You know, why can't that be yeah. You know, becoming more Christ-like? That to me would be, you know, Jesus is kind of the best male enhancement, I would think. But every time they say intimacy, what they really mean is, you know, kind of genital intercourse. And so as our culture says this to men, we've kind of lost the language to kind of even identify what the need is that we have. And are we allowed to have a need for intimacy that is not genital? I say, well, yeah, because that's a human need. So our culture really restricts the way that we think about masculinity, especially with respect to intimacy. And that's a major problem, I think, that we have in the church.
So what you're saying is that a person who has wholeheartedly bought into a cultural idea of masculinity and is going out into the world and is being titillated with various images of women and they're becoming aroused, that because the brain is so malleable and has been so shaped by this cultural identity of masculinity, that it's naturally going to associate, I desire to be intimate, therefore I need sexual release.
Exactly.
Is that kind of the idea there?
Exactly.
In addition to that, what you're saying here also has some implications for how we talk to our children about their masculinity or their femininity, in particular, how a father talks to his son about masculinity and what he, in both his spoken and unspoken ways, teaches his son about what a man really is.
Exactly. Because a man is not just about having as many orgasms as is convenient or needed, or maximizing them. You know, that masculinity and being a male is first and foremost about being human. And it's a particular way that you act out your humanity, given the body that you have. And so, you know, just kind of, you know, I've got a son who's 8 and, you know, we're watching a soccer match and there's a commercial will come on. And, you know, and I'll look over and I'll say, hey, did you see that? And he'll kind of get a weird look on his face like, oh, yeah, I saw it, but I don't know if I want to say that I saw it. And I'll say, how do you think that the brother of that girl feels? Because you've got two sisters. How would you feel if your sister did something like that? You know, how would you feel about that? So trying to teach him what's the right way to look at women, to kind of get beyond just seeing, you know, the bikini or the body parts. And so it's interesting because he's 8. I'm sure that will change when he's 10 and certainly when he's 14 and 18.
Right.
And so to get beyond seeing human beings as pieces and treating them as people who are created in the image of God. And so to give him the language to use to help him understand, you know, who he is and what he's going through is the most critical thing, I think, for a father to give his son.
And that language really needs to be informed by Scripture. And
yeah.
So what does the Bible say? How does the Bible present a picture of masculinity? What does it look like?
Well, you know, and that's where, not to cop out real quick, but I really believe that the picture of masculinity is Jesus. I mean, when you look at who Jesus is, when you look at the things that he does and the things that he says, that's the Bible's picture of masculinity, is in the person of Christ. It's in sacrifice. It's in, you know, challenging, you know, the forces of this world, where there is false religion, where there is oppression of the poor, you know, setting the prisoners free. And in some ways, I think when we really stop and think about it, we say, as guys, I can get excited about that. I can get excited about going out and sacrificing myself for something bigger than just me. True masculine nature defends. It doesn't dominate. It defends. You know, looking at Jesus, you know, Jesus is about defending the poor. He's also about sacrificing himself for the benefit of others, about restraining his power for the benefit of others, giving of himself for, you know, for the benefit of others. For me, the person of Christ is what true masculinity is all about. The person of Christ also has a singular love for his church, and that is seen in the marital relationship between a husband and a wife. So, you know, if you want to kind of get into the details of, you know, manipulation of the genitals, that's the wrong place to start. It's in the person of Christ that is the true perfect picture of masculinity.
Jesus Christ is perfect theology. That's
yeah,
awesome.
Exactly. Yeah.